As we look at the current issues of warfare, both as they're considered biblically and prophetically, and also the wars of the 20th century, it is impossible to analyze what really goes on in warfare or why without looking behind the scenes at some of the mechanics. And of course, this affects not only the wars we've experienced in the 20th century, but also those wars which we are possibly going to experience as the 20th century closes out and the 21st century begins. And so we have two guests joining us in this roundtable discussion. Chuck, why don't you introduce the first one?
Well, Dr. Stan Monteith is with us, and he has been a guest on some of our shows in the past, and we've also enjoyed Radio Liberty, one of his ministries. He's also famous for the book on AIDS, The Unnecessary Epidemic, also on a book on sustainable development, a syllabus. And also, Stan, the republishing of Foundations book, right?
That's right.
Stan, nice to have you with us. I appreciate your taking the time to join us. Stan and I know each other also from the Council for National Policy and some other involvements, and I really do appreciate it, Stan.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
And Dr. Dennis Cuddy is with us, who is the author of Secret Records Revealed, The Men, the Money, and the Methods Behind the New World Order. Dennis, nice to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
And, well, gentlemen, I appreciate your joining, and one of the things that we're going to try to focus on is what does our present horizon look like from the point of view of international conflict? Is there a prospect, not that we'll answer the question, but what's the question that's in our, you know, in a definitive sense, but certainly the question in the back of our minds is, as we go into the 21st century, we have major clouds on the horizon. Are these just threats? Are they just bargaining chips? Or is there a real prospect of international conflict looming again to cloud our future and to endanger our families? As I survey the information that seems to be emerging from the intelligence groups on China and Russia and even North Korea, some of these dangers seem very real. So what's your reaction to that, just to start the ball rolling?
Well, let me just comment that I believe that all of the wars of the 20th century have been contrived. Starting with the Boer War, you can't understand the Boer War unless you understand there was a secret society created by Cecil Rhodes that was really behind this effort to destroy the Afrikaners, or the Afrikaner republics, unite them with England with this dream of creating a world government. And then if you go into the First World War and the Second World War and Korea and Vietnam, you'll find these same forces at work. But you have to understand that behind this whole movement, behind Cecil Rhodes' secret society, and behind the entire movement for world government are Luciferian forces. And when you put that into perspective, it changes this whole perspective. In other words, behind this move towards world government, behind all of the wars of this century, in my opinion, have been dark spiritual forces. And we can't look at what's happening today, the way we're building up the military potential of communist China. We are financing the military potential of Russia, and we are creating the best enemies that money can buy, I believe, in preparation for a coming war.
I've heard these conspiracy theory kinds of things for years, and of course I've trafficked in some of the literature just for my own awareness, and I always regarded it rather skeptically, except for the point that you emphasized, as you just made. Those conspiracy hypotheses seem pretty conjectural until you recognize who the real master conspirator is. I've always wondered, how can a cabal of some kind with some kind of global political ambition survive generation to generation to generation to generation, which of course is the whole Illuminati concept and the rest of it, and that doesn't make sense until one acknowledges the fact that this really is a spiritual dynamic, and that we have a Lucifer or Satan or whatever you want to call him behind the scenes. Am I summarizing that fair?
Absolutely. In fact, you go back and you read Jeremiah 11:9, and I believe it's Ezekiel 22:25, and the Lord in his word talks about conspiracies, and it's the same conspiracy. They talk about in Jeremiah 11:9 that the men of Israel have turned back to their ancient gods, and they're no longer seeking the God of the Bible. And of course, the ancient gods are the pagan gods of Luciferianism. That's what it's all about. It was the same thing at the time of Jeremiah and Ezekiel. It's the same thing today.
Dennis, what's your reaction to the discussion so far?
Yes, I would agree. The Bible, of course, there's a famous quotation about warring against principalities and powers. And so the struggle between good and evil, God and Lucifer, would be a power struggle which is played out through individuals, men, and groups. And so in the quest for power, you often have economic considerations. They contribute to that. And war is a strategy toward achieving that end, toward achieving power. So after, for example, the Boer War, the same sort of individuals who were the successors to Rhodes' plan, Lord Escher, for example, meets with banker Morgenthau, and they literally discuss how they can get America into the First World War. They say, we need to shed American blood as soon as possible, and you find J.P. Morgan loaning tremendous amounts of money to the European allies, and then to protect that, what happens is America is coerced, more or less, into entering the war. And it's not just the entrance into the war, but then the result of the war is to get these principalities, nations, into more debt. And so you successfully pursue this over the years, World War I, World War II, even minor wars. You want to set up situations. For example, in the 1950s, we wanted to get in place the Shah of Iran. And what happens there is, behind the scenes, the CIA may, in that country or other countries, foment uprisings. General Schwarzkopf's father was instrumental in that back during the 50s through CIA funds through Alan Dulles. And we won't go into it too much, but if you look all around, the beginning, the middle, large, minor, and the after effect of wars, there's economic pressures brought to bear, even in Kosovo.
Let's go from the Second World War on. Can you fold into this tapestry Korea and Vietnam, for example?
Sure. It's like a step-by-step, and you need this sort of regional map, as it were, where oil, for example, is a big part. We put pressure upon Japan. Japan wanted the oil of Southeast Asia. Lo and behold, the war starts. They thought it would be in the Philippines, but it's in Pearl Harbor, and you have this whole system of deceit going on there to involve us. FDR knowing about Pearl Harbor but not saying anything about it. Churchill also knowing about it. Various individuals. The minor wars afterwards. You have the Marshall Plan after the Second World War. Involved in that situation, not only that, but China becoming communist in 1949, what Marshall did undercutting Chiang Kai-shek. Then you move into Korea, but what happens there? Well, MacArthur is prevented from doing what he has to do to put down the North Koreans and the Chinese coming across. So it's a master strategy. In fact, MacArthur said, I got the feeling, and actually later on I have a quote where about 1960 he finally figures out what did happen. There was a secret agreement that he would not be able to use the force that was necessary. And what you have in the grand strategy is revealed in some quotations, for example, out of a CFR, Council on Foreign Relations publication, where it says, if the communist threat had been greatly abated, the West would have lost whatever incentive it had for world government. So as Dr. Stan mentioned, world government is the key and the economic control that it would involve, and this would place the power into the hands of the power elite. And that's why you have, and we can get to that a little later, not only Kosovo today, but Bosnia before it.
Dan, you want to jump in here?
Well, I don't think you can understand the threat from communism today unless you go into its traditional threat. In other words, communism starts in Russia in 1917. Everybody thinks that there is a battle between the Russian communists and the United States. And yet if you go back and you read Herbert Hoover's memoirs, which we have, you'll notice that of the countless millions of dollars we sent to Russia following the First World War, when communism was being established and saying we're going to destroy the West, communism is going to destroy capitalism, and you would think that we would have used our relief efforts to try to put down communism, and yet 97% of the medical and food supplies sent to Russia by Herbert Hoover under his auspices went to the communist and not to the anti-communist. And of course you can read General Wrangel's diary. He headed the Army of the South, and he tells how the British undercut him. You go into the background of Admiral Kolchak, who was fighting in, on the Eastern Front against the Communists, how we undercut him. You begin to get into the writings of Bruce Lockhart, who was sent to Russia by Lord Milner, and you find out that the Americans and the British were doing everything they could to back communism. Colonel House was doing everything he could to back communism. And, of course, then you get into the works of Anthony Sutton, Professor Sutton from Hoover Institute, and you find out that we have financed Russian communism since its inception, starting in 1918 and continuing right up to the very present. And all you need to do is look in the Wall Street Journal, and Russia has just defaulted on a $100 billion loan. And how are we approaching it? Why, we're giving them more money. We're financing tens of thousands of Soviet scientists who today are working on biological warfare with the, under the conception that if we do not finance them, they might go to work for Saddam Hussein or the Iranians, and we couldn't have that. What people do not understand is we've created the best enemy that money can buy.
Now, if as our listeners are listening to this, they obviously don't have the resources or opportunity to do the archival research that you've just alluded to. As we go along here, I'd love to think about pulling together a little reading list. If you know, a casual layman would like to somehow get up to speed a little bit, at the same time, with some reasonable efficiency, what works would you guys recommend that they turn to? To get a global perspective without having to get into the archives like you have.
Well, if I could mention Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution by Anthony Sutton, Western Technology and Soviet Economic Development by Anthony Sutton, I believe Herbert Hoover's memoirs, General Wrangel's memoirs, Bruce Lockhart's British Agent. The excellent book by Ed Griffin, The Creature from Jekyll Island. These are just a few of the ones that I think will begin to give people an overview. I think Anthony Sutton's National Suicide, pointing out how we financed the North Vietnamese all during the Vietnam War. And I might mention we have a video entitled The Best Enemies That Money Can Buy, which is my interview with Professor Sutton, which I did back in 1980, going into the funding of the Russian communists, the Nazis, and the North Vietnamese. And, of course, we funded all of them.
Yeah, and how do they get that, Stan, as long as they got you?
Well, those are available, those, at least the Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler and the Wall Street and the Rise of Bolshevism are available by calling our 800 number, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. My video, The Best Enemies Money Can Buy, my interview with Dr. Sutton, with Professor Sutton, is also available from that number, along with our video, The Brotherhood of Darkness, which is just an overview of the world Luciferian movement, and I think it's about time that we begin talking about what we're up against. Somebody wrote a book called None Dare Call It Treason. Somebody wrote a book called None Dare Call It Conspiracy. I think we ought to have a book that says None Dare Call It Lucifer, because that's what it's all about.
That's well put, and I might mention to our listeners that I would endorse Stan's recommendation wholeheartedly. I know him well, and I appreciate that background.
Let me mention Dr. Cuddy's book, Secret Records Revealed, a must for anybody who wants to get into the background of much of this.
Well said. Good. I was about to turn to Dennis to comment. What else would you recommend, Dennis, as homework for an interested listener?
Well, that's a pretty good list right there. I just toss in from the viewpoint of the establishment,
yes,
they also might like to take a look at Tragedy and Hope by Carol Quigley, since he's Bill Clinton's mentor, and it's a rather large book, but still it goes through the period of the century and covers some of this.
Okay, one of the questions we need to ask here is, given the fact that we financed all of these various things from the Bolshevik Revolution going on, what was the reason for doing that? Why did we need the best enemies that money could buy?
Well, the thing is that had we not had an enemy, do you think the American people would have financed this massive military complex? Would they have been willing to pay the massive taxes that were needed to create the welfare state? Vietnam was fought not to defeat the North Vietnamese, because if we tried, we did a terribly poor job. I mean, how could a nation the size of the state of Mississippi stand off the mightiest nation in the world for 10 years and then end up defeating the United States? Unless we didn't go into the war to defeat the North Vietnamese, we went into the war to socialize America. Vietnam was utilized to change America, and if you doubt that, the reference would be Foreign Affairs magazine, January 1967, the article written by McGeorge Bundy, who led us into the war. He was the head of the National Security Council, and he says there quite openly in his article, The End of Either Or, that the road forward at home is not by persistence in Vietnam. If you believe in the great new departures in health, in education, and in welfare, don't say we ought to get out of Vietnam, because the opposite is the case. Pull out of Vietnam, and there'll be tremendous reaction against our programs here at home. And that's what Vietnam was all about, and that's what the whole enemy is all about. It is simply a distraction.
Let's go from here. You made allusion earlier. I want to return to the whole Bosnia, Kosovo scenario. So would one of you pick that up?
Well, let me go into that by adding to what Dr. Sand just said. If you figure that the ultimate goal is ultimate power, and you're going to use economics to do it, and you're therefore going to create this situation through various wars, because wars are useful to build certain powers up and tear others down and to gain strategic advantages, you look backwards and see how that has been furthered. And at the start, you would say, for example, what Colonel House, Woodrow Wilson's primary advisor, when he was talking about the establishment of the League of Nations, he said, if war had not come in fierce and exaggerated form, we would not have been able to have the League. Now, of course, the League was not totally embraced by the American public, and so then we had to have the United Nations. However, that wasn't satisfactory to groups like the World Federalists, because you had a veto in the Security Council. And so you have various Rhodes scholars, for example, along the way, like Harlan Cleveland, authoring books like The Third Try at World Order. And that would come a little differently through economics. It's very much like Richard Gardner, a Rhodes scholar who's prominent in the Clinton administration, saying that they would get to their house of world order by eroding national sovereignty piece by piece, and he said how they would use GATT to do that. So what you do is you look at both of these together, and you say, what is our problem? Well, we need these regional economic alliances, okay? Let's say Europe. How do we get Europe united? Well, there's a problem. It's in the Balkans. Germany needs a route down to the sea, and the Balkans is a very unstable area. Now, what do we do about that? And so what you have is the situation in Bosnia, where you have to have intervention. And even on top of that, you have this thorny problem of the Serbian ruler Milosevic, and he has to be put in his place. And so then you have Kosovo. And I would refer your listeners to, I think they can still get Nightline with Ted Koppel, March 23rd, 1999, either in a transcript form or off the Internet. And on there, they're playing a short statement. I'll just read it. It's just three sentences or so long, where Clinton is talking very truthfully. And he says, and if we're going to have a strong economic relationship that includes our ability to sell around the world, Europe has got to be the key. And if we want the people to share our burdens of leadership with all the problems that will inevitably crop up, Europe needs to be our partner. Now, that's what this Kosovo thing is all about. So that's why when 2 million Christians are being slaughtered in the southern part of Sudan, or hundreds of thousands in Rwanda, we don't deliberately intervene because of our humanitarian concern that we say we have. What you have to have is this stable Europe, so that it forms a European Union. We've already got Tavistock and some others piloting smart cards that will have students skill credentials so that they will be portable if you go from Brussels to Idaho or Idaho to Brussels to be a plumber or electrician or whatever. And so you have a total, and they say this, we have a new transatlantic agenda, it's called, and you have a total integration of the economies of these regional economic arrangements that we've had. That will form a world or global economy, which will have to be managed by a world government, which was the ultimate goal.
I noticed that we have right in front of me here a proposal for NAFTA, a military proposal that apparently the U.S. War College is urging a joint command with Canada and Mexico and the U.S. And this plays in the same thing again: the breakdown of national sovereignty on the one hand through things like GATT, and then the linking up of regions like NAFTA did economically with Canada and Mexico. Now I see they're proposing a joint military. One of the things about the Kosovo thing that startled me, and that's why I see the link here, is that we have NATO, which was formed in 1949 as a defensive alliance for the first time in its 50-year history, being offensive. In fact, it had redefined on April 24th of 1999 as a global policeman. And in so doing, we violated all the international law in the books, the Helsinki Accords of 1975, the Vienna Accords of 1980, and even our own War Powers Act, where Clinton has used NATO, ignoring the UN even, the UN Charter, and going in on an offensive basis. Now, one of the things that John Loeffler has highlighted all along, and we've run several articles by Jim Herson in our own newsletter on this, is the violation of international law has gloomy effects for us domestically as well as internationally. When we throw the rule of law out the window, we really are ready to reap the whirlwind. And so here we see ourselves on an international basis going into Europe, making up the law as we go along. And what you both have highlighted here then is that this is not a random knee-jerk reaction. You know, many people think this is it's just Clinton struggling for power, trying to get Chinagate off the front pages or something like that. You're really saying that this is far more sinister, that it's marching to a much broader agenda. Is that correct?
Absolutely. And, you know, there's nothing new under the sun. This idea of world law, the responsibility of nations to adhere to world law or we'll never have world peace, was used during the First World War to justify England entering World War One. And England's justification for going into the war was because she had a treaty with Belgium that went back to 1870. And there's a wonderful book, it's called Confessions of a Reformer, written by a former liberal named Frederick Howell. And he believed in the First World War because it was simply carrying out a treaty obligation. And he was actually asked to go to Paris by Colonel House and Woodrow Wilson, and his job was to go over the various treaties dealing with Mesopotamia following the First World War. And he pointed out that England, first of all, had promised to give the Palestine area to the Arabs, then they promised to give it to the French, then they promised to give it to the Israelis or to the Jews, and he said, you know, they don't believe in world law at all. I mean, they would violate their treaties before the ink was even dry, and he suddenly realized the whole First World War in this idea of international law had simply been a cover for creating a war, and that's exactly what we're doing as far as Kosovo is concerned. I believe that this is a stepping stone towards the world dictatorship, which is really what energizes Bill Clinton and Tony Blair and all of these people who are part of this whole world internationalist movement.
You know, I hear what you're saying because when in 1993, when Maastricht was signed, I had the privilege of traveling with Bill Middendorf, our ambassador to the European Union, and we had a chance to interview somewhere between 40 and 50 of the top leaders in Europe over a whirlwind kind of several-week tour. And what was startling as I went and met with members of the French Assembly, as I met with members of the House of Lords and House of Commons, as I met with members in other countries. In each country, it was clear that the chicanery and subterfuge that was manipulated to get masters signed through those legislatures. In each country it was different, but in each case there was clearly an underground movement, a sinister movement really, to foist this masters treaty in effect on the electorates. And it, of course, the masters obsoletes the Treaty of Rome, and it moves into a move towards the United States of Europe. But the point, without getting into all that, the point is that had I not really had a chance to visit with these people, I would have treated this whole hypothesis suspect, that there really is a very well-organized but hidden movement to maneuver these various entities into place. And guys, I say this because, you know, when you first hear this kind of talk, it sounds so the conspiracy theory has been, the press has been successful, I think, in marginalizing that whole idea as being sort of extremist, naive, whatever. But what's startling, when I have experts like yourselves, and as one does the homework, you begin to realize that the only way you can rationalize history is to recognize that there is an agenda. And all of that sounds preposterous until you acknowledge that there is a master puppeteer.
Can I suggest that probably the best single book right now is Dr. Cuddy's Secret Records Revealed, The Men and the Money. And really, this is a magnificent book that will give any one of your readers, the documentation they need to realize that there is an invisible force working behind the scenes, and everything in that book can be documented, because I've bought many of the original manuscripts to to be sure, and I've never found any flaw any place in Dr. Cuddy's work.
Well, that's high praise indeed. I appreciate that plug. Well, where are we today? You know, we look at China is now through its espionage and through its assistance by the President administration in a position with 12,000 mile range missiles. The CSS-4s, there are 13 of the 18 are targeting United States cities. They now have multiple warheads miniaturized, so they represent a very formidable force, even against hardened sites. And and classified documents seem to indicate that they operate under the belief structure that a war with the United States within the next 20 years is inevitable, and they're preparing for it. We shift over across the Atlantic and look at Russia, who has got spending $6 billion on an underground city to prepare for nuclear war. They have two towns, 60,000 population each, just supporting the workers for this project. We find them, aggressively modernizing their missile capabilities, their nuclear capabilities, even though other aspects of the military are neglected or in shambles. As you look at all that, I'd like you both to focus a little bit. What's your personal perspective of our present jeopardy?
Dennis, go ahead.
Well, it seems imminent in a way, but again, if you look at what the grand plan is, it may not be. The world planners use war, but it's for a particular purpose, and it's strategically placed. For example, in the First World War, you have Sir Edward Grey misleading the Germans, and so that contributed to that. As I indicated earlier, April Glaspie misleads Saddam Hussein. He thinks he can go into Kuwait, but then we use that to cover our bases regarding Middle Eastern oil, which is important. As Dr. Sand mentioned earlier, with the Russian threat, you have an enemy. Now that the alleged demise of the Soviet Union has occurred, you need a new threat, and so it's China. But to what extent are they a threat? Now, what we do is say, well, China would be foolish to engage in a nuclear strike against us, even though they have maybe, I think, like 13 nuclear missiles, because we would retaliate. The problem with that is it works the other way around, too. If they took conventional action, let's say, against Taiwan, would we initiate a nuclear strike knowing that they had those 13 nuclear missiles? And so what you have is nuclear blackmail as the largest possible threat, at least in Southeast Asia. Now, the strategy of the world planners is to boost them up economically to a point where they could do, for example, what they did to Malaysia. What you have is a lot of the central banks deliberately selling off a currency of a country to force them into economic ruin, and then the IMF can come along and say, well, this is what we have to do to get your house in order. This is what they did essentially to the major power of the Soviet Union. It was sort of an economic meltdown that occurred. And so through these two things, I think the plan of control is in line that way, very much like with Russia early on. If the communist threat had been greatly abated, they were referring to Russia. And so what you have to have is a somewhat increasingly strong China, the possibility of a nuclear blackmail, but the purpose is so that we will not lose whatever interest we have in forming this world government. It's all of a strategy moving us towards this ultimate world government, which will be a synthesis, I think, of Western communism and Western capitalism and Eastern communism into a world socialist government. And they had to have two models. In Asia, it's Hong Kong, formerly capitalist, taken over by communist China, and in Europe, it's Germany, the combination of Eastern Germany, which was communist, now with Western Germany, into essentially a socialist entity. And so you have to put all the pieces of the puzzle together. There is a threat. There is a threat. It has to be a perceived threat. But I think the world planners figure that through economic means, they will manipulate this into a rising pressure that this is just too much for the world to bear, and we really do need this sort of world authority, the international police force or whatever. Now, it's not going to happen immediately because China is, you know, at a point where it's just stubborn enough and figuring, well, we can exchange missiles, so you lose Los Angeles and we lose Shanghai. So what? We've got a billion people or so. So they don't want to press this too far. So there is a threat, but I think the world planners think they can handle it. The problem is, eventually, they'll make a mistake, and that's when you get, you know, Armageddon and the whole bit.
Well, there's a couple other aspects to this. I think all of us indulge, I think, in an oversimplified model, looking at capitalism on the one side and communism on the other. One of the things that's becoming more and more obvious is what some people are calling the third way. And that's where, in effect, you've got an affiliation between big business and big government that really leads to what used to be called fascism. In other words, businesses that the government pretends you own, but in fact you respond to government constraints to an increasing degree. And the strange partnership that I'm beginning to perceive between the large multinational corporations and the globalists, I used to think that was just a marketing aspect. I'm beginning to think it's far more sinister. So that's one dimension. But let me shift a little bit on a comment, in a sense, sort of in rebuttal to you, Dennis. I sort of felt that way, the way you sort of profiled, up until more recent times, trying to see, see a softer macroeconomic kind of strategy. Except I noticed some things that I find extremely disturbing. I see China and Russia militantly preparing for nuclear war, defensively and offensively. On the one hand, I find our present administration divulging virtually all of our secrets to our erstwhile enemy, China. I see, at the same time, two things also emerge that I have personal knowledge of. I sat on a board with Dr. Edward Teller at one time, General David C. Jones, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and Tom Hayward, Chief of Naval Operations. And during that era, this was just the end of the Reagan era, before the Clinton administration, I discovered from their insights, E-Ring Pentagon insights, that they knew that Russia's strategy was a preeminent first strike. In fact, they were all the Russian senior military leadership has their training on the basis that they'll have the advantage of surprise. So that was well known within the strategic community in the late 80s. What startles me, that is no longer secret. On December 17th of 1997, Boris Yeltsin issued a 37-page document admitting publicly that the Russian strategy is a first-strike strategy on any issue that threatens the proximate interests of Russia. So that's now in the open. And while we're doing that, Clinton has shifted the other way and essentially dropped our strategy of launch on warning. In other words, the idea of retaliation, our whole strategic doctrine now is to sustain a first strike before hitting the enemy, which in my perception is absolute insanity, first of all, because a good first strike would prevent, would eliminate our capability to respond. But secondly, it such a doctrine, not only espoused, but actually embedded in our procedures, which is underway right now, is an invitation to a first strike. So as I watch the shenanigans of our present administration in this area, as I watch Russia's continued preparation, on the other hand, and I watch China in the same mode, it looks as if, this is, it's almost as if our administration seems to be prompting some kind of an incident of some kind, as if that would somehow move forward. Now, that's the, when I see all of that, it lends credibility to a hypothesis that I heard years ago that I never embraced, and that was that it's the prosperity of the United States that at the moment is an obstacle to the globalist agenda. That, and if that's, if that hypothesis is, has validity, it could undergird a view that there may be an agenda here to precipitate an event because of some perceived opportunity to move their closer to their goal. What's your reaction to all of that, gentlemen?
Well, I'll go because I don't think it's really a disagreement with what I said originally. The third way essentially is the synthesis. It's a sort of a corporate fascism, but that would be a form of socialism in a way. So the third way, if you look at it, Tony Blair and the Schroeder and the rest of them are members of Socialist International. It's correct. U.S. prosperity is a problem, and that's why you have these various economic arrangements to redistribute the wealth through the World Trade Organization, and so on. I still would say that just as Harry Hopkins gave a lot of our nuclear secrets to the Soviets, it doesn't surprise me that our administration today would be lax in allowing China to obtain those secrets. But toward what end? If they were going, the Soviets then, or the Chinese now, or Soviets now, for a first strike, they could have done that many, many years ago. They've had nuclear submarines and still do, I think, sitting off our coast. By the time you blink your eyes, the whole eastern part of the United States is gone. So they could have done that if they wanted to. Why not? As I said, I think behind the scenes there's more to this going on. It may be through what we don't know in terms of our satellite technology, in terms of super laser weapons, that the threat to those individuals is so great that they perceive from their own self-interest that they would not survive first strike, and so even though they could literally crush us or half of us and blow up the world, the same thing would happen to them, and it's just not worth it. However, biblically, eventually you have passages in the Bible where it says one third of the waters will be with blood and one third of the air and so forth. So I'm not dismissing the possibility, the very real possibility that eventually there will be some sort of nuclear exchange. It's just that I don't think it's going to happen anytime soon.
What's your reaction, Stan?
Well, I think you have to look at things logically. And as you were saying, we have been building up communist China. Whether the Republicans or the Democrats are in the White House, we always give the most favored nation treaty status to communist China. When the Republicans are in power, the Democrats, complain. When the Democrats are in power, the Republicans complain. And I'd like to suggest there's not a dime's worth of difference between the two of them as far as our foreign and domestic policy positions are. And Barry Goldwater said the same thing in his book with no apologies. It doesn't matter who's in the White House, the same foreign and domestic policies continue. That's on page 279 of his book with no apologies. So it does not make sense that we have put China into a place where they could get loans from the World Bank, which we finance, loans from the International Monetary Fund, which we finance. Most of their industrial expansion has come because of loans from Goldman Sachs and Lehman Brothers and other major American corporations dominated by Rhodes Scholars, people from the Council on Foreign Relations, and this whole group of people who are totally dedicated to this concept of world government. Now, logically, it doesn't make sense. sense any more than it made sense that for the last 70 years we have been financing Russia by one guise or another. And today, with Russia's gross national income about $15 billion, according to some of the interviews we've done, they're spending probably two-thirds of that money modernizing their nuclear strike force, developing their civilian defense system, building new nuclear submarines, the new intercontinental ballistic missiles. None of this makes sense, you know, unless we understand that there is some sort of a secret agreement between the leaders of America and the leaders of Russia. And you can see glimpses of this from time to time. You can see this in MacArthur's book, Reminiscences, where he talks about the secret agreements between the American government and the Chinese communist government that he was never allowed to learn about. If you read the publications put out by our invisible government, the Council on Foreign Relations, you'll find out that regularly there are articles written by leading communists. In fact, the most treasured possession at the Harold Pratt House in New York City, which is the headquarters of the CFR, is a copy of their magazine read by Lenin. Why? Because both the communists and the people who run America have the same ultimate goal, a one-world government. And what everybody has missed, I believe, is the fact that communism is not atheistic. Karl Marx was a Satanist, and this is beautifully covered in a book called Marx and Satan by Richard Wurmbrand. Not only Karl Marx, but the other socialists in the middle of the last century, they were all dedicated to Satanism. And you say, well, what's that have to do with anything? Let me point out that one of the world leaders today is a man named Mikhail Gorbachev, former dictator of Russia, a former head of the Soviet KGB, who has been given the Presidio to use, he along with a number of other occultists, to use. You and I couldn't get into the Presidio and get facilities there, but Mikhail Gorbachev can. At the recent meeting of the Bilderberger meeting in Portugal in the early part of June, and we have only the information that's available to on the internet, but they were talking about the coming crisis with Y2K, that we needed some sort of an international czar to supervise what was going on in the world with the coming crisis, and the name that was raised was Mikhail Gorbachev. Now, there's something wrong with this scenario. There are obviously forces working behind the scenes, spiritual forces, which are influencing domestic policies, and that's what we have to recognize. And then, of course, the dark forces have their plan, and God has his own plan. And my fear is that God is going to bring terrible punishment someday on America. It may not be logical, but it would be God's judgment.
Well, gentlemen, this is provocative. Let me raise a couple of questions I'd like to throw at you on the behalf of our listeners. One is, we disparage the ability of nations to maintain, any integrity regarding agreements. Why would we feel that these alleged secret agreements between various, our administration and Russia or whatever, would have any higher honor is one of the questions. But getting to another aspect of this, the whole idea that the CFR, the Bilderbergers, or whomever, that there's a smoke-filled room some number of men that in effect are controlling, or better, more precisely, attempting to control world affairs, all tends to ignore the rise of Islam. Clearly, I think I think the term "wild ass" is used in the Book of Genesis to characterize the Ishmaelites. Not that Islam is descended from Ishmael; that's a whole other controversy. But speaking in the popular folklore vein, the fact that the Muslim world has access now to nuclear weapons, it's my perception of from history and from what I think I know about that part of the world, is that anyone trying to count on them or control them in some against some master plan has to be guilty of a lot of naivete in these grand schemes, be they of Cecil Rhodes or be they of any other council. The wild card, the monkey wrench in the works, has to be this strange collection of tribal lore that we call Islam. And so part of the risk that I see is all these plans, even though I don't agree with them, setting those aside, the real issue is the loose cannons around that now have the ability to wipe out major segments of our society. And what worries me a bit, especially as I study Isaiah and Hosea, and I see the kind of attitudes God evidences on nations that he blesses and then that turn out to be disloyal to him, is that his justice has to be vindicated. And all of that, all those passages would argue that America is overdue for judgment. Here's a heritage and a blessing that we've enjoyed for two centuries. And I also notice the two-century mark seems to be very characteristic, whether you're talking about Nineveh and Assyria, or whether you're talking about Samaria and the Northern Kingdom, or whatever. There seems to be a two-century threshold at which God says, hey, enough's enough. And if that's the case, America would seem to be overdue for God using its enemies as a form of judgment, quite apart from meetings that go on in various societies, and quite apart from cultural traditions that we've talked about. So one of the things that concerns me, and I guess I'm really returning back to the original thought, is I sit with my family looking at the horizon that constitutes the 21st century. I see nuclear weapons everywhere. We've got, over a dozen nations with nuclear weapons. We've got over 23 countries presently building ICBMs, and we've got 66 countries with the technology to field a surface-skimming cruise missile. And they're all mad at each other, and certainly most of them, a large segment of the world, is really hostile to the United States. At the same time, I sense at least some validity to the idea that these transnational rulers of wealth, who are not by any means necessarily rooted in our economic culture, our prosperity is really an encumbrance in terms of their own schemes. This all sounds to me like a recipe for instability for the year 2000, 2001, 2000 and N, whatever. What's your reaction to that, gentlemen?
Well, could I just comment that men have plans, and I believe that there are people of great wealth who are dedicated to this idea of world government. They have their plan. But somewhere in the Bible, and I'm not a Bible scholar like you are, Chuck, I mean, it talks about how God sort of laughs at men's plan. And I remember something that a very wise man once said, and that is between God, man's plan in time and God's plan in eternity, there is an infinite quality of difference. I believe we are moving into terrible times, terrible instability. I can foresee a nuclear attack, biological and chemical warfare. I can see a collapse of the infrastructure of our society coming with Y2K. This is not what the other side necessarily plans, but I believe God is eventually going to have to move against America because he is a God of justice, and our nation has turned our back on him.
Dennis, you want to pick up on that?
Sure. I think there probably will be something in the future. I just don't know that it's imminent in this sense. You asked initially, why would they honor any agreement? Well, they could probably say, why would Clinton be expected to honor any agreement or anything else? I mean, I don't mean that necessarily in a negative way. We haven't even stood by our friends. We didn't stand by Taiwan either. So it's not a, you know, we're the good guy, they're the bad guy necessarily. It's just there's a lot of reason for no one to trust anybody else. So I think they've probably reached a situation where they really don't have to trust anybody else. There may be more going on than meets the eye. It's sort of like that film, The Brotherhood of the Rose, where it said intelligence agencies, you know, the KGB, CIA, and Mossad, and everybody are really running things anyway, and they're all in league with each other and sort of a brotherhood of their own. It's really not presidents and premiers and prime ministers. I'm not sure that that's the case, but still, we don't know what the national security agency's capabilities really are. For example, the head of Chechnya thought he was safe because he stayed on the telephone, I think, no more than his cell phone, no more than 5 minutes, but he didn't figure that we had the ability through triangulation to locate him quicker than that, and lo and behold, here comes a missile. I think more realistically, although there could be an exchange between India and Pakistan, there needs to be, you know, there's two generations since Hiroshima, there may need to be one nice big nuclear blast to get everybody in line and willing to give up freedoms and so on. What's more likely is the, as you mentioned first, the terrorist sort of attack. But even then, I have to wonder, there's these 200 small nuclear devices in these Russian suitcases, and apparently nobody, Gaddafi or anybody, has been able through, you know, millions and millions of dollars to obtain even one of these. And even during our war with Saddam Hussein, there wasn't one aspirin bottle tampered with in the U.S. by any Iraqi agent. So I have to wonder whether there isn't some sort of agreements or intelligence capabilities that will, you know, forestall a massive mistake on the part of the power elite. Now, I have no doubt that there may be some sort of terrorist small nuclear blast or an exchange between two countries, India and Pakistan. But the purpose would be to say, oh, well, this just shows you we need to go forward with that early 1960s agreement where we would limit the arms of countries to only internal domestic purposes. And, of course, we'll have to have cameras on every street corner. We'll have to put a camera in your television so that we can see whether you're plotting a bomb in your home. We'll have to limit your guns. And so I have no doubt that in the probably near term, there will be some such incident, some terrorist incident or some small nuclear exchange, but it will serve a larger purpose, which I think they have already planned for. Now, I don't want to, you know, sound like they know everything and they control, because eventually there will be this Armageddon, and there will be the end times, and there will be the fulfillment of the Bible. It's just that I don't see the end of the world coming in the near future.
I don't either, by the way, just to set the record straight here. And there's another scenario. Let's set Armageddon aside for the moment. Ezekiel 38 and 39 describes an invasion in the Middle East by Magog and her allies, led by Iran, incidentally, in which God intervenes in a very strange way. Among other things, it involves hailstones of fire falling upon the invading forces in Ezekiel 38 and 39. But in chapter 39, verse 6, there is a verse that's troubled many of us that have really spent some effort in prophetic inquiry. And that is, it says that I will also send fire upon Magog and also them who dwell carelessly in the remote shores, remote islands. And what that hints at is the possibility, at least, of a nuclear exchange, in which it may be that the hailstones of fire that fall upon Magog or Russia are our missiles, and conversely. And that whole incident, for lots of other reasons, appears to be a prelude to the classical seven-year scenario, and the ultimate last half of that 7 years being the tribulation, and obviously finally climaxing in the Battle of Armageddon and all its attendant incidents. The point is, the Ezekiel 38 event appears to be the event that triggers God's redealing again, once again, with Israel and so forth after the church period. Now, if that view is correct, it does seem, in fact, even Joe DeCourcy at Intelligence Digest has emphasized that a view, at least, the Intelligence Digest for the last 60 years has scooped the CIA a number of times. They feel that the decision has been made in the Kremlin to move in the Middle East when the time is right. If Russia is, for its own internal political reasons or whatever, going to involve in some kind of intrigue and miscalculate the brinksmanship that would ensue, deterrence depends on credibility, and I don't mean just technological system credibility, but the credibility of the executive at the button. JF Kennedy pulled that off in the Cuban Missile Crisis back in 63 or 62, whatever it was. He had credibility personally, and of course we had the facilities at the time to get Khrushchev to do a turn 1-8 and send his ships back. It could very well be that under the present circumstances, with a present lack of credibility of our chief executive, a miscalculation on the part of a brinksmanship situation, confrontation of some kind, could lead to miscalculations and could very well lead to that, which implies an exposure. See, whenever you have all these nuclear weapons running around in the hands of desperate and unreliable people, I think we've got a formula for concern. And so on the one hand, I find it very illuminating to start getting into taking some of these conspiracy views much more seriously, especially in view of Ephesians chapter 6, on the one hand. On the other hand, exposure, the endangerment of the American people by the president administration's deliberate unwillingness to mount a missile defense just shatters me to the core. And we haven't had a chance in this time to really get into domestic policy issues here, but we'll just touch on this one anyway. How does Clinton's unwillingness to defend ourselves, provide for our defense, fit into the globalist agenda?
Could I just quickly take that?
Sure, go ahead.
Because it didn't start with Bill Clinton. You'll recall that Ronald Reagan, President Reagan, talked about building a strategic nuclear defense system.
Sure, Dr.
But, of course, the media called it Star Wars. Now, we could have, at any time, begun deploying something. We had already had a ballistic missile system around our weapons back in the 1970s. They were dismantled under Jimmy Carter. They could have been put back in place. In other words, we could have done that under the ABM Treaty. They could have begun deploying certain things in space, certainly not the full Star Wars, but there were things that could have been done under Ronald Reagan, and despite what everybody has said about how he wanted to do it, he refused to do it. And then, of course, George Bush comes in, he refuses to do anything. So we should not simply point a finger at Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton is a corrupt and evil man, but it didn't start with Bill Clinton. This has been bipartisan, and the absolute refusal to defend America and to have this concept of mutual assured destruction, and now, of course, with the Soviets having a defense for themselves and an anti-ballistic missile system, we seem to have put in place a system of not mutual assured destruction, but assured destruction for America.
Assured vulnerability, some people call it, and I understand. At the same time, the question I'm having is why don't we... where's the outrage in the Congress? Why aren't we taking steps to prepare ourselves, especially since it's now an N-person, non-zero-sum game? It's no longer a two-person game as it was in the 50s with Russia, USSR and USA. Today we've got a plurality of threats. Why is there such a sinister portent ascribed to the ideas of putting weapons at risk rather than cities at risk by having a space-based defense? How do you guys see that policy as fitting into the globalist agenda?
Well, picking up on what Dr. Stan said, you remember when Reagan made that statement about Star Wars, somebody asked him, well, if you got this technology, would you give it to the Soviets? He said, sure, I would, because it serves a larger purpose. We are, just like mutually assured destruction, we are supposed to be vulnerable. And so if we had total superiority and total safety and so forth, then we wouldn't be vulnerable and we would lose whatever incentive we had for this world government, and the rest of the world, knowing that we were superior, would not go along with it anyway. They may have a panic. They may launch or try to launch a preemptive strike from 7 miles off our coast or whatever the situation, or gang up on us or whatever happens. But my question is not so much that it will or won't happen. I think you have a very valid point. I think ultimately it probably will happen. It's what happens first. For example, when you're talking about Gog and Magog and the invasion from the north and so forth, is that before or after the allusion early in the Bible to when this time comes, the daily sacrifice will have been ended? It will be very terrible if it occurs in the winter, and women who give suck and so forth. That almost implies sort of an anti-Christian persecution return to pagan child sacrifice occurs at some time. Now, does that happen before this, or does it happen after this?
The nuclear event happens prior, but that's technical. We don't have to get into that here on this thing. I think the Matthew 24 allusions are post Ezekiel 38 events for a number of technical textual reasons, but let's set that aside without getting into the eschatological details.
Uh-huh.
I think the risk of a nuclear event seems to be proximate in the text of the scripture as well as our own immediate horizon, and that's, I guess, what gives rise to this whole gathering right now, because I have to tell you, I am intrigued when I see men of your stature. And also, I should share with you a meeting. I won't mention the names, but I had a dinner meet. I was in Washington, and I had a very select dinner meeting of, I guess there were less than 15 people at the dinner in a private dining room context. and very, very prominent people whom I really respect highly also. And I was startled to realize they all took the conspiracy theory point of view, if I can put it that way, for granted. And, you know, it's one thing to, you know, wade through Carol Quigley's Tragedy and Hope and to read some of the things that we've all just alluded to here on the one hand. It's quite another to realize that the most informed people I know in Washington, as they indulge in speculation, it's all from a base of taking for granted that there is a master agenda controlled by a relative few that are attempting to nudge the world into this globalist agenda. And again, though, the loose cannon on deck are the Muslims, because they're a major, major player, and they're totally uncontrollable. History really bears that out. They're all mad at each other, let alone the West, and yet at the same time are in possession. Some of these suitcase nukes are in Iran, at least seven of them. And so the point is, I do understand from my sources that a number of them, some undetermined number, are in the U.S. in the hands of groups waiting for a coordinated program of some kind. The real risk is if we're going to, just to broaden this discussion a little bit, is not just nuclear. Perhaps the dream weapon of the terrorists, of course, is anthrax and its derivatives, the genetically engineered alternatives. Because they virtually defy discovery and have deep, deep, long-lasting and contagious effects. So the threats to our culture and our country are far more than just the ICBM nuclear idiom, if you will. But in any case, I think the perspective I'm getting from all of this is that the horizon as we go into the year 2000 and beyond is certainly not going to be placid, smooth, easy sailing of prosperity in our time. It's going to be one of tensions, of turbulence, and probably a significant reward to those that are prepared. I'm just groping with what kind of preparation makes sense. John, did you want to chime in on this one? I see you
I was thinking two things, one of which is the issue of it is not necessarily a conspiracy of people sitting in a back room with cigars. It's an interactive group of people who sit in high places who have a common belief and goal. There's a lot of difference between that. It's more like an association than a coordination. That would be number one. Number two, I think your idea is correct, and I've seen another article on that, and that was the whole issue of the New World Order crowd, or the global governance crowd, that's their latest term, is cozying up to the Islamic world. The Islamic world will never tolerate the syncretism that this global crowd is trying to push. And I think Dennis might have something to say about that. But that's ultimate a rupture. And so the question is, does the scripture prophesy something that men try to put together and it really blows apart at the end? In other words, they lose control of it. Mm-hmm. And then something... Satan's general plan is always to deceive, use, and trash in that order. He'll deceive you first and he'll use you for his purposes. And just when you think you've got it under control, he throws you the curveball and you're out, you know. And then it goes on to what he really intended in the first place.
Yes, picking up on what John was asking about the Islamic world, I think that is the more likely scenario, because the scenario that he mentioned about the globalists trying to put this all together, and just when you think you got it, it blows up, because biblically it says when there will come a time when they say peace and safety, and then, you know, all heck breaks loose. And so I think that's the more likely scenario, although I'm sure there will be some terrorist, a small atomic suitcase, whatever, or some incident between two warring factions, India and Pakistan. But there's the unknown factor in this. For example, Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber, a lot of people don't know that he was part of the CIA's mind-controlled experiments back between 58 and 62. Arafat disappears for 7 days in the desert. He comes out of this sort of groggy, and lo and behold, he's now for peace. Reagan's calling the Soviets the evil empire. He goes in the hospital some days later. Now they're wonderful. Let's have the Soviet-American exchange agreement. Now, I'm not saying that there's necessarily anything going on there, but I still come back to the fact that if everything is just sort of going along and you have everybody, including the Islamic fundamentalists, operating on their own, and they're clearly capable, as you said, some nuclear devices in this country or however many there are in Iran, I still ask myself, why wasn't there even one aspirin bottle tampered with during the Iraq war that we had. It seems like the first thing they would have done is you know, try to create a scare within this country of, you know, let's put a little botulism or something in an aspirin bottle, and, oh, my goodness, you know, where is it going to happen next? But for some reason, in this desperate situation, as far as Saddam Hussein was concerned, not one of his agents did one thing internally in the U.S. Now, what does that mean? Does that mean that the National Security Agency and somebody is, you know, mind-controlling everybody? No, but there is that unknown factor, as John mentioned, of this sort of association rather than the back room. And it may be that there is this sort of network of individuals, whoever they are, I'm not saying it's Rockefeller and those people, but some sort of network who is in more control than we may believe. However, what John said at the end, I think, is although there will be these, you know, initial terrorist acts or nuclear exchange, but the purpose of that will be to get the people to say, oh, my goodness, you know, we need the world government, no guns, all that sort of thing. I think the more likely scenario is they'll probably get their way pretty much along the line, and then at the end when they cry, say, peace and safety, that's when it blows up and you have the scenario that Chuck was mentioning.
Well, gentlemen, how are we doing, John? We're
an hour in right now.
We're an hour in right now, yeah. which is in my mind is probably all we need. We can carry this on for a little. Are there
get closing thoughts?
Yeah, that's the easy way to do it. Let's just do that. Let's get closing thoughts. Stan, why don't you go first?
Well, I am very, very concerned about what's going to happen after the first of the year. The information we are getting is that our Defense Department is not ready for Y2K. They did not start working a decade ago as Social Security did, although obviously the people in positions of power knew what was going to be coming down. They've known it since 1968 when Bob Beamer, who wrote much of the COBOL language, was going around Washington, D.C. saying, don't you know what's going to happen with the coming of the year 2000? The computers are going to collapse, and we know the book Computers in Crisis, written in 1984 by Jerome and Marilyn Murray, was saying exactly the same thing. The government obviously knew it in 89, started working on Social Security, but they didn't start working on other major government functions until quite recently, and it takes a decade to solve this problem that was artificially created by dropping the first two numbers in the date of the year. So I am very concerned that we may be having real trouble with our government structure, with our defense structure, and of course similar things are going to happen all throughout the world. I think we are moving into a time of chaos and crisis, and in a period of this type, certainly there is great opportunity for those people who hate us to move against America. And I will tell you, an old adage is you never poke a stick at a rattlesnake unless you're going to kill it. And yet we have antagonized Saddam Hussein. We have antagonized the Iranians. We've antagonized the people in the Sudan. We've antagonized the people in Afghanistan by attacking them with missiles. I think that the Arab nations hate America. And not only that, but now the Chinese hate America because of the bombing of the embassy. We have undone all of the goodwill that we've created in the Russian people over the last 70 years. Many of the Russians now look upon America as the cause of their problems. I think we are moving into a very, very uncertain world. And I would just suggest that people go back and read the story of the third of the Punic Wars, when you had a nation, which was Carthage, that would make any concession for world peace. And they were at one time had been the most powerful nation in the world. They had been able to hold their own in two previous wars against the Romans. But in the final analysis, they would make any concession. They were willing to unilaterally disarm. They were willing to send out their sons and daughters to be taken hostage by the Romans. But the Romans were intent upon winning the war. And, of course, we know what happened at the end. After being betrayed by their leaders, and Rome moved in, killed every man and every boy, and took every woman and a girl away in slavery, and then tore down the structure of Carthage stone by stone and plowed salt into the ground where once Carthage had stood. Could that be what lies ahead for America? What is God's plan for America towards a nation that's turned its back on the wonderful bounty he's given us? My concern is I don't believe that God any longer blesses this land.
Dennis, what's your closing thoughts?
Well, I agree that it probably does look like a time of some chaos will be coming upon us. However, I think it'll be chaos with a purpose. There's the saying, they will bring order out of chaos, and usually it's a scenario, whether it goes X or Y, they have the scenario plan so that they can, the power elite can benefit from it. You remember that old poem around 1930, The Hollow Men, where it says, we'll end not with a bang but a whimper. In the end, we're supposed to have the 7 years, but the first 3.5, the people think it's okay, the Antichrist, and prior to that, there will be a voluntary giving away of our freedoms, and I think Dr. Stan is right. Any nation that permits partial birth abortion has really forsaken God, and we're seeing the fruits of that destruction now with the adoption of the current moral lack of standards. So it will be a period of chaos, but I think there will be a little more control or purpose to that chaos than most of us think. However, it will blow up in the end.
Well, gentlemen, I on the one hand, we have rather a gloomy, dismal close. It's certainly a challenging close. It's certainly a time for all of us to do our homework, especially in Ephesians 6, not just Ezekiel 38, because I think the opening insight that was put on the table by Stan and has continued, is that the real master planner here is Satan in terms of any kind of conspiracy. But, of course, God is really in control, and we, if we're in Christ, we can look at all of these things with a certain academic detachment because we know how it all ends. But I certainly appreciate you both being with us in this little roundtable discussion, and I also appreciate your being available to us on our radio programs, and I look forward to seeing you at the next CNP meeting or however, either here, there, or in the air. Right, gentlemen?
God bless you.
God bless you guys. Thank you. John, are we...
Yeah, we're down. Okay. I will get some information from both of you on ordering and stuff, because we've got to edit this whole thing and drop the stuff in there.
Yeah, we want to just keep the part we agree with, and we'll edit the...
All right. Yeah, John, we do carry Tragedy and Hope, and of course all of Carol Quigley's work, you know, through our ministry. And we carry Dennis's books, too. We just bought, I think, 2 cases of Secret Records Revealed.
Thank you.
That's such an important book.
That's really good. Okay.
I really do appreciate you guys being with us. It was a long hour, kind of a grueling hour in terms of some of the content, but it certainly is. This whole conspiracy thing is something I've been wrestling with for many, many years, because on the one hand, there's an abundance of evidence for it, and on the other hand, it's so disturbing to try to really see the world through those eyes. Howard,
could I suggest that you borrow John's copy of the Brotherhood of Darkness audio tape? We have it in a video, but I know how busy you are and sitting. But maybe when you're driving around, John would let you borrow that tape, because I think it's as good an overview of the spiritual aspect behind the world conspiracy as any that's out there.
Brotherhood of Darkness. Great. I appreciate that.
That's because there are too many clues.
There are too many clues, right.
That's right. You'll understand when you listen to that tape what I just said.
Okay, gentlemen.
Okay.
And I really do appreciate your tutoring, because it means a great deal to me to get up to speed on this, because I'm getting very concerned. I'm getting, of America. I'm first-generation American, and it's taken me a long time to divest myself of the myths of the past.
Well, I think it's so interesting that you had this dinner meeting with these 15 leaders, whoever they were, who all recognize, you know, that there is a force behind what's going on today. And that's the subject we have to get to the American people, but we cannot get it to them unless we put it into its spiritual perspective. And Christians ought to be able to understand what it says in 1 John 5:18 and 19, the world is controlled by the wicked one or the evil one or Satan, depending upon which biblical translation you use. The world is under the control of basically of Satan. Now, God is ultimately in control, but Satan's got free rein right now, and he's doing a bang-up job.
And he's a usurper, but we have the escrow closes in Revelation 5, right?
Right.
Okay, gentlemen. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.